A black and white photograph of a man in a Nazi uniform standing in the back seat of an open-top car.
Nazi war criminal Hermann Göring. A member of Hitler's inner circle and a leading architect of the extermination of the Jews. This is Bettina. Göring was her great uncle.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, I look like Hermann Göring. Yes, that's the whole story. I probably look more like him than his own daughter does. My brother looks like my mother's family, while I look totally like my father's family. I sometimes feel jealous because the other side of my family is much healthier. It's awful, isn't it? I inherited all the crap. The two men from the stairs enter an archive storage area.
Armand Göring was the sadistic commander of the Plaszów concentration camp in Poland. He was responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands. This is his daughter, Monika.
Many people tell me that I look like my father. But I'm not Armand. I have nothing in common with him either. A younger woman. It's a very heavy burden, having someone like that in the family, this close. It's something that just keeps hanging over you.
Heinrich Himmler was one of the most powerful men in Nazi Germany, leader of the SS and the Gestapo. His great-niece is Katrin Himmler.
In our family, Heinrich was so awful, such a huge monster, that all the other members of the family, who were also ardent Nazis, became utterly insignificant. No one mentioned them. No one asked any questions. A photo of another man in uniform.
Hans Frank was another of Hitler's closest associates. As Governor General of occupied Poland, he was responsible for the ghettos and the death camps. This is his son, Niklas.
Your sweat drips between your shoulder blades and into your butt crack. You shuffle ridiculously because of the chains on your ankles. They pin your arms on the right and the left, like they've done around the world since the dawn of time, as if you lost your ability to walk at the moment of your arrest. Then they lead you up the 13 steps, put a hood on you and a rope around your neck, and onward to eternity. Having your neck broken spared me from having a screwed-up life. How you would have poisoned me with your brainwashing, just like they did to the silent majority of my generation, those not lucky enough to have had their father hanged. And so, I'm glad that I'm your son.
Rudolf Höss was commander of the Auschwitz concentration camp. His grandson is Rainer Höss.
Warum existiere ich?
Why am I alive? To carry this guilt, this burden, to try to come to terms with it? I think that must be the only reason I exist.
For the descendants of Hitler's most hated henchmen, will the past always be present? And will the future ever be free of guilt? This is the story of how five men and women have struggled to free themselves from the sins of their forefathers.
Hitler's Children. An oil painting of Hitler is brought out of storage.
The Institute for Contemporary History, Munich.
The two men carry a wooden box through the archive facility. They place it carefully on a wheeled trolley. The box has scuff marks at the bottom. Rainer Höss is straightening up his tie.
Rainer Höss wants to show a family heirloom to journalist Eldad Beck.
One of the two men unlocks a door. The trolley bearing the box is wheeled into a service lift. The doors are closed and one of the men travels with the container.
This fireproof chest, weighing 40 kilos, was a gift from Himmler to Rainer's grandfather, Rudolf Höss.
Rainer looks tense as he awaits its arrival. I remember the day my mother took everything out of the chest. I didn't know what was in it then. She opened the chest. The lid was quite heavy. The stuff smelled awful. Moldy. Everything simply smelled old.
As a boy, Rainer was sure the box would reveal yet more horrors of his grandfather's reign as the Auschwitz commander.
He opens the chest, then he and Eldad pull on white gloves.
But instead, the box contained a series of photographs documenting the private life of the Höss family. Rainer's father and his brother and sisters growing up in a grand house, separated from the gas chambers by just a few yards. This is what he wanted Eldad to see.
Mm-hmm. So that's the gate of the villa? Yes. And the camp is behind it? Right behind it. Yes, the photos show the children going out of the gate towards the main administrative building, here. Yes, this is the gate. And they lived in Auschwitz. Yes. And obviously no photos show. You can't see anything from the camp. No, it's an idyllic family setting. It's very well done, isn't it? There's no crematorium. No, everything they had there, the toy car and the plane, was made by the prisoners.
Rainer's father is the younger of the two boys in these pictures. He grew up in this idyllic villa in the grounds of Auschwitz.
My father. I think this will interest you. Yes, this is very odd. What is it, actually? The locomotive. It's a children's book about a locomotive. My father got it as a Yuletide gift, 1944, from his father. How old was your father then? He was born in 1937. So he was seven. Yes. And they lived in Auschwitz. Yes. Right next to the camp, where trains full of people arrived every day.
Journalist Eldad Beck is a third-generation Holocaust survivor.
He told me that for years he was prevented, especially when he was a schoolboy, from participating in visits to Auschwitz because of his name. That seemed totally strange to me, because if anyone should visit Auschwitz, it's the children and grandchildren of the people responsible for the horrors committed there. I told him, I've never been to Auschwitz, you've never been to Auschwitz, let's go together. Rainer, this gate, the most pervasive image in my subconscious is going through that gate to see, what did they see? What did they know? Rainer and Eldad are walking along a train station platform.
Rainer and Eldad agree to make the journey to Auschwitz together. The descendant of a Holocaust survivor and the grandson of a man found guilty of genocide.
A black and white photograph of Rudolf Höss. Now in a car.
Niklas Frank, a generation older than Rainer, was able to witness some of the horrors of Hitler's Holocaust at first hand.
A photograph of Niklas with his mother and father. My mother picked up the phone and called my father. Hans, come quickly. Hitler is on the phone.
Hitler ist am Telefon.
He ran out of the bath without wrapping a towel around him. That's what my mother said. He stood at attention, probably his penis too, and he spoke with Hitler on the phone.
Vermutlich auch noch sein Glied in der Abachtstellung hat er dann mit Hitler telefoniert.
Glowing, he turned to my mother and said, Brigitte, the Führer granted me the general government of Poland. My father, according to the laws of the Third Reich, became Hitler's representative, the Führer's direct deputy in the occupied Polish territories. Niklas's mouth twitches.
Childhood for the descendants of the Third Reich could never be entirely innocent. For many, it was also devoid of any parental love. On the train to Auschwitz, where his father spent his early childhood, Rainer Höss recalls a cold, distant relationship.
I think my father has that same cold nature, since I've known him, actually. The thought never came up to sit on his lap. Not like you saw my own kids do. The relationship I have with my children, a warm family relationship. There was no warmth between my father and us. Never. He told us what to do, and we obeyed. He set the rules, and we obeyed. Eldad gazes out of the train window. My father never let us show weakness, show emotion. He hated that to death. Whenever we cried, we were beaten even more, just for crying, not for what we'd done. What I consider even worse is that he never abandoned that ideology. He remained a zealot for the Third Reich. I've had no contact with my father since my parents' divorce. I don't want any contact with him anymore either. In a village.
Niklas Frank's childhood was equally devoid of parental love.
My mother didn't care about us at all. I was speaking with my brother recently. He's now 80 years old. Do you remember any warm hug or a kiss from our parents, specifically from our mother? No, it never happened. A photograph of Hans Frank, stern-faced, his dark eyes staring into the camera with an air of defiance and challenge. In countryside.
Monika Goethe was only 1 year old when her father was tried and hung for the murder of tens of thousands at Poland's Plaszów concentration camp. She was brought up by her mother, as if the horrors of Plaszów had never happened.
A childhood photograph of Monika.
She refers to her father by his first name, Armon.
Photographs of Armon, bare-chested and sunbathing in a deck chair. There were pictures from Plaszów. I really liked the pictures. They had dogs there. I've always loved dogs. And there were horses, the house, and a garden. I had this image I created of how the Jews in Plaszów and Armon were one family. Of course, sometimes stern measures were necessary. But all in all, at least they didn't go hungry.
Sie mussten wenigstens nicht hungern.
And they had a place to sleep. And you couldn't compare it to an extermination camp like Auschwitz. I was actually very happy that the Jews were with my father.
As she grew up, Monica began to question this rose-colored version of her father's history. And she confronted her mother.
Then I had second thoughts. Armand, what did he actually do in the camp? A photograph of Armand wearing a wry, twisted smile. It was a work camp. Oh, it was a work camp, not an extermination camp. A work camp. And what did they do in a work camp? They worked, said my mother. What else would they do? Yes, I said, but weren't there children and old people there? What would children and old people be doing in a work camp? Thank God. One less worry. At least it was a work camp, not an extermination camp. I said to her, he didn't do anything to the Jews, right? She answered, yes, he may have killed a few of them. A few, I asked. What do you mean by a few? Two? Three? Four? What?
Keine Antwort.
No answer. Yes. This interested me. Maybe it was more. A few leaves a lot of room for the imagination. But she didn't answer, and I kept asking her, how much is a few? Three, four, five, six, seven, eight.
Und ich lächelte sie immer so dabei an.
I smiled at her the whole time. Then she, I don't know, she was like a mad woman. She ran inside and came out with a long electric cable. She whipped me with it. The plug hit me in the head. I kept raising my hands to my head. On Monday morning, I had black and blue marks all over. A photograph of the teenage Monica, holding a fawn in her arms and gazing down at it tenderly. Niklas is driving, then standing at the open boot of his parked car.
Niklas Frank has written books about his parents and what it was like growing up as the son of one of the leaders of the Third Reich. He describes how his mother loved going shopping in her Mercedes, escorted by the SS.
Mother was certainly thankful to Hitler and Himmler for the ghettos, for those supermarkets that gave a discount to the Frank family. I was allowed to join her. We passed broken people. Children glared at me.
Niklas tours Germany, reading extracts from his work. He presents his parents as he continues to see them as monsters. And he is equally tough on himself. Here he describes a day out to visit a concentration camp.
What was even funnier, though, was our trips to the barracks, surrounded by lots of barbed wire fences. I now know it was an external wing of one of the concentration camps. There was a friendly uncle there in uniform who had a donkey. I roared with laughter as they sat skinny men on that donkey. Strong German hands sat them on it. The donkey bucked and the men fell off. They got up very slowly and, unlike me, didn't find it so funny. They kept sitting them on the donkey, one on top of the other, and slapped the donkey on his ass. What a wonderful afternoon. Inside, I would drink cocoa with the senior officers. Niklas's youthful audience looks solemn, but captivated by his story.
Katrin Himmler thought she had a good relationship with her father, until she started to research into the family's past.
With my father, I always thought I could have a frank exchange of views, but I discovered very quickly that there were boundaries he would not pass, Because it was too painful for him.
Für ihn eine sehr schnell eine Grenze gab, wo er nicht weiter konnte, weil es für ihn zu schmerzhaft wurde. Also, ich habe ihm immer alle
I showed him all the important documents that I found in archives or in the literature. I wanted to talk to him about them, but it always ended quickly. At first I was very disappointed. I thought we could talk more. I think I could only understand how difficult it was for him when I realized how difficult it was for me to accept that my own grandmother was a Nazi. A photograph of Hitler with his senior staff.
Katrin's family descended from one of the most notorious of all Nazi war criminals. Her grandfather was the brother of Gestapo and SS chief Heinrich Himmler.
A photograph of Himmler with a blonde-haired little girl. I never met my grandfather, but I knew my grandmother. I really loved her. I was very fond of her. It was very difficult when I found her letters and learned that she maintained contact with old Nazis and that she sent packages to a war criminal sentenced to death. It made me feel sick. It was very difficult for me. A black and white photograph of a smiling Himmler wearing round glasses standing beside Göring. Bettina, Göring's great niece, is leafing through a pile of aging photographs. She spreads them out across a small round kitchen table.
Bettina Göring remembers her grandmother denying that there had been any wrongdoing by the family at all.
I was like 11, 12, something like that. We saw a documentary about the Holocaust on TV, and she was there, and she'd say, "It's all lies, it's all lies." And we went like, "How can you say that? I mean, look at all that, what happened." So I remember that. That was a big fighting already, yeah, at home. So yeah, I mean, that's how those people dealt with it. If they would have admitted what happened, I mean, it would have been terrible. So best way to go is say it didn't happen at all.
A picture of Göring wearing an Iron Cross medal at his throat, moving along train tracks at night.
The night before his arrival in Auschwitz, Rainer is tormented by the thought that he might be recognized, identified as the grandson of the concentration camp commander.
Eldad withdrew into himself and read the paper. I was nervous. I tried listening to music, which didn't work. I was afraid that the people there, when I get there to Auschwitz, the fear that I look so much like my grandfather, that people would recognize me.
Dass Leute mich erkennen. Diese Angst, dass man mich
that
ansieht,
fear
ich bin Hüss.
That they would see on me that I'm a Hüss, that I'm his grandson. It may be incomprehensible to people who don't have that name, or who have no connection with a camp like that, with Auschwitz.
Ja, zu Auschwitz.
As Rainer gazes out of the window, a fleeting image appears of Rudolf Hess. In a compartment.
As he tried to go to sleep that night, he realized that another source of anxiety was the pictures from his grandfather's box. In particular, the photograph of the gate which separated the grand home from the horrors of the concentration camp.
Again and again, that damned gate appeared before me. I called it the gate to hell. Of all the photos, it was the one that brought home to me that at some point I'd have to look through that gate. Rainer stares at the photograph of the gate.
The gate to hell began to symbolize for Rainer the doorway he was stepping through himself, to face and to try to separate himself from the full weight of his past.
Rainer puts his photos aside and switches off the light. Monica walks across a stretch of grass, then pushes open a wooden gate.
Sooner or later, all these sons and daughters of the Third Reich have looked through that gate to have the horrors of their forefathers revealed to them. For Monica Goert, the chance came in the form of Manfred, the owner of a bar in Munich.
I often went to this pub in Munich. The owner was a lovely gentleman. A tall man with black curly hair, very good looking. He, Manfred, entertained people in his pub, and I really liked him. That day, the waitress was ill, so Manfred rolled up his sleeves and took off his watch to wash the dishes. At that moment, I saw the number. Most of the people had left, so I said, "Tell me, Manfred, in which concentration camp were you? I see you were in a camp. You wouldn't know it," he said, "and let's not talk about it anymore." Oh, I said, "What do you mean I wouldn't know it? I've read a lot of books about Auschwitz and Anne Frank. I know a lot about Poland," I told him. "And my granny is from Katowice. I'm not as ignorant as you think. I want to know where you were. You can tell me that."
"In Plaszów."
"In Plaszów." "No," I said, "you were in Plaszów. You know Plaszów." "But of course," I said, "my father was there too." "Do you know my father?" "I couldn't have known everyone, Monica," he said. "There were lots of people in Plaszów." "You know what?" I said to him. "He was Goert." "He didn't know any Goert." "What?" I said. "Come on, Manfred," I said. "Don't make up stories. Goert was the commandant of Plaszów. If you don't know who Goert was, you couldn't have been in Plaszów." Suddenly, he went as white as a wall. He glared at me, took a step back. Behind him were bottles, shelves of whiskey bottles. He stared at me the entire time. Suddenly, he screamed, "You mean Goert? Poles can't say Goert. They say Goert instead." I said, "His name wasn't Goert, it was Goert, just like my name." But he only knew me as Monica. Suddenly he screamed, "That murderer, that pig." A photograph of Armand astride a horse.
Armand Goert was portrayed by Ralph Fiennes in the film Schindler's List. It was this film that finally brought home to Monica the full horror of her father's history.
I went inside. There was nothing about Armand at first. It was all Oscar, Oscar. Then a car drove up with four SS men in it. At that moment I knew, this is Armand. No one had to tell me that. It was like being struck. It was him. I kept thinking, this has to stop. At some point they have to stop shooting, because if it doesn't stop, I'll go crazy right here in this theater. Monica looks haunted.
Monica left the cinema suffering from shock. She now knew what her father had been.
Mugshots of Armand Goert. At Auschwitz, the vast furnaces stand cold, and a mountain of shoes are piled up behind a glass wall. Rainer is walking with a woman.
Auschwitz was organized as the first. The commandant, the organizer, appointed for this place was Rudolf Höss.
Rainer arrived at Auschwitz fully aware of the reputation of his grandfather, Rudolf Höss. And he had known about the villa, the idyllic home on the edge of hell, for most of his adult life.
The woman unlocks a wooden gate, then heads through it, followed by Rainer.
But he was now about to see it for himself, for the first time.
The gate. My private hell.
Rainer is immediately drawn to the gate and looks again at the photographs of his own father as a boy, growing up in the shadow of the gas chambers. The boy who would grow up still enamored with the Third Reich.
Rainer holds up a photo.
Horrible, horrible.
Here they're murdering people
millions.
By minutes.
Child.
And they bring their families here and they, you know, they grow their families here.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything is just as normal as it should be.
Yeah. Horrified.
This is the date the villa was built.
Build these buildings, yeah.
Wow.
Entering the villa itself,
it's a pleasure.
The guide points out how close the family would have been to the gas chambers.
You see, and small garden. Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's go. Yeah. And small garden, yeah.
Yeah.
We got this inside, yeah. So, we close these two rivers, Sowa.
Yeah.
And these small gardens, you see, and walls from camp, you see? Original.
Yeah.
You see? Yeah.
So they are so close, the whole family close to the chambers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your father grew up with this.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
the smell, with the smoke.
When they pick up the strawberries, my grandmother said, please wash it first while it smells about ashes, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Rainer to Eldad. It's really insane what they built here at the expense of others. And the gall to say that it never happened? We were always fair. We were always good. We didn't do it. A garden like this doesn't grow by itself. It doesn't just pop out of the ground suddenly, just like that. Insane. When you see the dimensions, the size, it fits the delusions of grandeur perfectly. My father had delusions of grandeur, just like my grandfather, always at the expense of others. Insanity. Insanity. The woman padlocks the wrought iron gate set in the centre of the high wall, then walks away. Rainer and Eldad move off together, side by side. I've been trying to imagine this entire time, how every morning he'd put on his uniform, put on his belt, stick his pistol in it and put on his beret, kiss on the left, kiss on the right, the very thought of it. I'm going to kill a few thousand people now. We'll meet afterwards for coffee and dinner. And tomorrow, children, we'll go on a field trip. Rainer looks overwhelmed and walks away from the camera to have a few moments to himself.
It took Rainer until he was in his mid-40s to make this trip. Some of the descendants of the Third Reich don't get this far. Others have denied, ignored, or turned away.
Strips of barbed wire are cast into silhouette by a grey sky. Katrin walks to a ticket machine at an underground station.
For Himmler's great-niece, Katrin, the shadow of the Holocaust hung more heavily over her when she traveled abroad.
The bad feeling overwhelmed me whenever I left Germany. Then it became more unpleasant and I felt less secure. I dealt with the problem the same way other young Germans did. It wasn't because of my family specifically. I heard from many other people of my generation that when they went abroad, they tried not to be seen as Germans. In other words, not to speak German, not to tell anyone they come from Germany, to try not to stick out, to fit in. We'd be thrilled if they thought we were Dutch or Swedish. Then we'd be ecstatic. The main thing was that no one would think we're Germans. I devoted myself to learning foreign languages so well that no one noticed my German accent. That was always so important to me. Katrin is faintly reflected in the window of an underground train. Bettina is out walking her dog.
Good girl.
For Bettina Göring, on the other hand, getting away from Germany was a huge step forward on the way to coming to terms with her past. She now lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I haven't lived in Germany for 30, I don't know, some years, 35 years by now. It is easier for me to deal with the past of my family from this great distance. It's not our life, you know, we have to digest, but the life of our grandparents or our parents, whichever. And they didn't deal with it, or they couldn't deal with it, or only to a certain point could they deal with it, and then you kind of absorb all that stuff, and now we have to deal with it like sort of, I mean, you have to be almost psychic to deal with it.
Bettina may have found it easier to face her past since she moved to the United States. But how much is that to do with distance? And how much to do with isolation?
We live outside of Santa Fe, way out, actually. I don't think anybody's lived here for good reason, because there's very little water. We only get our water from rainwater, and we're off the grid. That's the other thing. There's no electricity, so we have to make our own by solar, and luckily we have a telephone company, so we are connected to the world through the internet or the telephone, but we're very far away from everything.
And yet isolating herself in a distant corner of a foreign land still couldn't excise all the demons of her inheritance. For Bettina, there was another, even more drastic step to take. Sterilization.
My brother and I both decided to be sterilized.
Uns entschlossen, also zu verschiedenen Zeiten diese Operationen zu machen, mehr oder weniger bewusst haben wir das gemacht,
we both did it consciously, more or less, so that there won't be any more Görings. Yes. When my brother had it done, he said to me, I cut the line. Bettina looks quietly contemplative for a moment. Then she's staring at a photo of Göring surrounded by three smiling young men. Students file into a room where Niklas is sitting at a table.
Niklas Frank thinks you should not try to escape your past. On the contrary, he works ceaselessly to bring the past to the attention of as wide a public as possible.
I was lucky. I can visit the archives of Europe and the US to flesh out the remains of your life. I can examine them undisturbed without the mask of family lies. But as much as I examine them, whether with a scalpel or a hammer, I always uncover a typical German monster. The students are silent.
Niklas tries to convince his audience that there is evil in the world. It exists. His readings are a warning.
Last night, at 3 a.m., I lay awake in bed, swore to myself again, no, I won't keep doing it. I have a feeling that I'm somehow, that the battle I'm fighting is already lost. I see it in your faces. I'm not the center of your attention. You have other interests, rightfully so. I imagine you said to yourselves, here comes another old fart to babble on about the Third Reich. I can understand that. I'm sure I wouldn't respond any differently. Some of the students lower their gazes so as not to have to look him in the eyes. Later, the lecture has broken up, and the youngsters are enjoying the sunshine on campus. Niklas is on the road. I've been visiting schools for years, whenever I am invited. I read from the two books I wrote against my parents. Each time I execute my parents anew. On the other hand, I tell myself they deserve it. The voice on his sat-nav gives him directions. He overtakes a tractor. I don't trust us Germans, unfortunately. I've had readings before adults, too, and I said, you're sitting here, and I think it's great that you came to my reading, but I must be honest with you and tell you that I don't trust any of you. Who knows? The economy turns bad again? You might get those ideas again. To follow a strong leader, restrict ethnic minorities, maybe even imprison them. You don't have to call it concentration camps. Here and there you have a little murder, a little killing. It might help purify the bloodline. Besides, it will create more jobs for the real Germans. Yes, I have my concerns. Katrin steps off her train.
Katrin wrote the Himmler brothers about her grandfather and two great uncles, and she has mixed feelings about its impact.
It was really good for me to write the book, and it's good for my son that I did it. But I can't speak for my family. I think some of them would see it very differently. Some of them see me as someone who shook up the family. Caused a disturbance to it.
Oder das Karma der Familie deutlich gestört hat und durcheinander gewirbelt hat.
Katrin's book about the Himmler brothers finally exposed the full horror of the past that her family had tried to keep hidden.
It also happens that family ties are ruined. If you let a demon like that out of the bottle, in any event, that is very painful. It's a pity that ties with certain family members were cut off or they're angry with me. It hurts. It's not nice, and I have to deal with it and face up to it. This, too, is a consequence of letting the demon out of the bottle, because many of them would rather keep it trapped inside. A woman asks Niklas, I'd like to know how your brothers and sisters responded. He replies, we were five children. As of March 31st this year, I'm the last one left because my brother died. He was the only one to support me. Whenever I showed him my new research, he said, I know, you proved it to me. Our father was a criminal.
Unser Vater war ein Verbrecher, aber ich liebe ihn.
But I still love him. Mein nächstälteren Bruder Michael. Then there was my other brother, Michael. When I wrote the book, Stern magazine published selections from it. When the first chapter came out, he wrote a letter to Stern's editors.
An den Stern geschrieben, worin stand,
he wrote, "My brother Niklas is a big liar. Nothing he wrote is true. He was always the black sheep of our family." Then there was my elder sister, who said from the beginning, "I don't want to get any older than Daddy was. My father was executed when he was 46 years old, and my sister Brigitte, named after my mother, got sick with cancer. She could have lived much longer. She committed suicide at age 46. The eldest of the five Frank children emigrated with her husband to South Africa because she really liked the apartheid regime. My last phone call with her went like this. I said, "Well, Sigrid, what are you doing now?" She answered, "Listen, we were just doing the calculations. How long it took to burn each Jew if 6 million were really put in ovens? Just 1.6 seconds. So it's all lies, all lies." She died there in South Africa. So I'm the only one left, as it should be. Raindrops patter on the surface of a puddle. Rainer and Eldad are walking together through Auschwitz.
In Auschwitz, an emotional Rainer has come face to face with his family's dark past. But he's about to face an even sterner test.
A group of students. We have with us today the grandson of the commandant of the camp, Rudolf Hess.
He stands before a group of Israeli students, unmasked as the grandson of the Auschwitz commandant.
Ask questions.
Ask the questions. I think it's...
it's better?
Yeah, a little bit nervous also.
A little bit nervous?
Yeah, it's the first time.
Why are you here?
Why are you here?
Warum bin ich hier? To, yeah, to see the horror what my grandfather made and the lies what I have all the years in my family.
You say lies. What lies?
The family, my family lies. I was a young boy when I met my grandmother, and I asked her a couple of times what's going on with the name. But there was no answer. I think a lot of these, it was not spoken in my family.
Do you feel guilty for what your grandfather did?
Yes.
Do you feel responsible for
it? Yes. Feel guilty.
Your grandfather actually murdered and tortured and exterminated. The girl speaking breaks down in tears, looking overwhelmed. She covers her face with her hand, then waves it in front of her, her dark hair falling over her face. As a teacher steps forward to comfort her, she continues saying, "He exterminated my family, and I wanted to know, isn't he afraid of these encounters with us?"
It's a pleasure for me.
It's
a pleasure for me. I feel sorry for that, what's going on with his family.
What would you do now if you were, can meet your grandpa?
Oh, you want to hear that, what I will do? I will kill him myself.
Zvika, a Holocaust survivor, asked me if he could shake his hand. He wants to shake his hand. As the elderly man comes forward to shake hands with Rainer, he says, "I was here." They hug, and the man continues, "I've been speaking to young people in Frankfurt for years now. I tell them, you weren't there, you didn't do it." Rainer breaks down in tears.
Merry Christmas.
The man moves away and Reiner wipes tears from his eyes as he turns to face the students again. I think I'd just about held it together, always with that feeling in the back of my neck that my father is standing behind me saying, don't you dare cry. You're showing emotions. Don't you dare show emotions. For the first time, you don't feel fear or shame, happiness, joy, inner joy.
Glück, Freude, innerliche Freude.
To receive the approval of someone who survived those horrors and knows for sure that it wasn't you, that you didn't do it. A man walks through Auschwitz with his arms around the shoulders of two younger people.
The lives of Hitler's children have all taken different paths as they have tried to face up to or free themselves from the sins of their forefathers. But can they ever truly escape the shadow of the past?
Katrin.
Diese Frage.
There's a question. What's it like to love your parents? If you want to be honest and really know what they did or thought, I think the interesting question is where we draw the line. People like Heinrich, who were almost as responsible as him, a little less responsible, and people who had a little more involvement in the crimes than my grandfather, these boundaries aren't easy to define. They're rather blurry. I ask myself again and again, at what point does it become impossible to love those parents? Until what point can you still love them? Where's the breaking point? I think that's a very difficult question, and that each of these children answers it differently. For the most part, I think that most children of the real Nazi criminals can't find the balance. Most decide to cut themselves off entirely from their parents, so that they can live their lives, so that the story doesn't destroy them. Or they decide on loyalty and unconditional love, sweep all the negative things away. I think it's very difficult to be caught between these two extremes. Niklas. But I admit that deep inside, I'm fully aware of the fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother. I just can't do it. I just can't do it, and I admit that I must overcome my inhibitions each time anew in order to do it. When we finish here, I'll feel a great sense of relief, because like any child, I also longed for my parents' love. It's obvious. I've been researching this for 3 decades now. I'll keep researching till the end of my life and always learn new things. My inner motivation was the hope that I'd find something positive about my father. Maybe he saved someone's life. Maybe it was even a Jew's life, or the life of a Pole. I couldn't find anything. I haven't found anything yet. Katrin. I tried my best to link something positive to this name, because I tried to examine this history. Personally, I think that I no longer have to be ashamed of this family relationship. I did my best to distance myself from it and to confront it critically. Of course, it never ends. I don't think this process is ever finished. Rather, it is something that we have to keep working at. I'm sure I'll be dealing with it for the rest of my life. Reiner, it's hard to explain the guilt. Even though there's no reason I should bear any guilt, I still bear it, carry the guilt with me in my mind. I'm ashamed, too, of course, for what my family, my grandfather did to thousands of other families. So you ask yourself, they had to die, I'm alive. Why am I alive? To carry this guilt, this burden, to try to come to terms with it? I think that must be the only reason I exist, to do what he should have done. A woman asks Niklas, I'd really like to know how much your wife and daughter could be a surrogate for your family and restore what you've lost over the years. How much they contributed to the writing of this book. I'd really like to hear something positive after all that. I love my wife more than anything. She loves me despite my flaws. We have a wonderful daughter. Unfortunately, she's an only child. We wanted lots more children. Our beloved daughter already has three children of her own. They visit us frequently, sometimes for weeks, in the role of domestic terrorists. If they weren't around, I'd be twice as fat. With his grandchildren, Niklas says, now Grandpa is going to sleep. No, Grandpa, no! Niklas asks his daughter, do you ever think of your grandfather? Not a lot. You were a sort of fortification for me. You shielded me from him. When I was younger, we had all these books in the house. I would read them when you weren't around. I'd read a lot and look at pictures. I wore the yellow star, all those pictures. And in school, I asked them to let me watch the films. And then when you wrote the book, you built this barrier for me, so he just faded away. You never told me that. And I didn't have to fight him anymore because you already defeated him, because you really let him have it. You ripped out his bleeding heart and took a bite. That made me so proud of you. You made those thoughts, you know, that when you are descended from bad people, you are also touched by evil. You took that load off me. For me, you are my fortress. Niklas, I thank you for that.
These children of Hitler can never undo the deeds of their forefathers. But by confronting their shared past in different ways, they have, perhaps, eased the burden of that guilt from the next generation.
Monica sits quietly with a little boy while Niklas heaves his grandson around like a great weight. He very carefully lowers him to the floor, a fond smile.
Tomorrow night at 9 on BBC Two, a new series goes behind the scenes of Billingsgate Fish Market. Over on BBC Four now, historian Robin Lane Fox investigates Greek myths.